This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. If you ask Americans to name the people who led the fight for civil rights in the 1960s, you probably hear names like Martin Luther King Jr., Rosa Parks, and according to Duke professor Michael Hart, contemporary movements like Black Lives Matter and Occupy Wall Street are simply missing these figureheads. So what have all these folks gone? Where have they gone? That's the question that is the jumping-off point for Michael Hart's latest book, Assembly, co-authored with Antonio Negri. It is a deep look at power structures and social movements and an analysis of how those movements can create lasting social change. Michael Hart is a professor of political theory in the Department of Literature at Duke University, also the co-director of the Social Movements Lab at Duke. Michael Hart, welcome back.
Thanks. It's glad to be here, Frank.
Let's talk about this idea that what political change and social movements looked like in the mid-20th century were movements that were highly centralized and led by charismatic figures. And we don't seem to be seeing that anymore.
That's right. I think everyone recognizes that, not only in the U.S., also throughout the world. It might be that with 2011, with the cycle of struggles from Arab Spring to similar movements in Spain and Greece and then Occupy Wall Street, that might be the time when people really recognized this change in, like you say, both the effect of not having charismatic leaders, as most progressive and liberation movements did in the 20th century, but also centralized decision-making structures. Now, I think really for the last 4 or 5 decades, there have been within social movements a struggle against that kind of leadership and that kind of centralization, a struggle against it in the name of democracy, in the name that people decide together within social movements. In the U.S., the feminist movement might be the one that's most clear and about this. Feminist movements in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, but in all of the different sectors of movements, in anti-racist movements, in student movements, in peace movements, there is a struggle for democracy within the movement.
Right. We certainly saw this within the civil rights movement. Ella Baker, student nonviolent coordinating committee, arguing vociferously that women need to be involved, women need to be in leadership positions, and it doesn't require a Martin Luther King. There's a lot going on the ground. And this was a robust debate going on back in the 1960s.
Absolutely. Right. It's been in some ways we have a long tradition leading to the present movement and these so-called leaderless movements. But then I think now we're the movements really are faced with, well, at least what Tony, my co-author, and I argue is a false alternative. It seems that they're faced with an alternative either that these leaderless movements, purely horizontal, distributed, etc., will remain ineffective, or one has to retreat to older forms of leadership. You know, how many times did we hear during the first weeks of Black Lives Matter that you'll never be effective until you find your Martin Luther King? Or similarly with Occupy, the similar kind of question about leadership. And so Tony and I argue both that that neither of these are really that these aren't our only options. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe put it that way.
With false dichotomy. But are there signs of success in these movements? I mean, if you go back to the Occupy movement, is there any sign of a result from that particular movement?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, in a moment, we can come talk about like what could be done differently or better or what activists are trying to do. But it is important, like you're suggesting, to recognize how important and powerful these social movements are, even when they're defeated. You know, so one could say Occupy, I mean, I would say more that it was defeated than it failed, but that that isn't what's so important. Think about with Occupy, for instance, how it changed the discourse in the U.S. about inequality. In some ways, the Bernie Sanders campaign wouldn't have been possible without Occupy. Both the questions about inequality, the discourse on socialism itself, but then also even specific things about free education, about attacking student debt, about housing debt, healthcare debt, all these specific points. So in some ways, you could say that the Bernie Sanders campaign, or even at a much broader level, the discussion of socialism in the U.S. today, which has now become not only anti-capitalism, but socialism itself has become a widespread thing. This, I think, is a profound result of something like Occupy.
And so which gets to whether or not we've been measuring success the right way. You would measure the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s by the success of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. So the legislation is passed and a number of regulations and laws all across the country paving the way for multiculturalism and racial equity. So we say, you got the law, you won. But maybe we should be measuring success in other ways, opening up the discourse, as you say, talking about things we never talked about before. Why are so few people rich and why are the rest of us struggling and we all work as hard? We never even got to ask that question in the 60s. The Me Too movement, for instance, not a law has been passed about women's rights since that movement evolved. And look at the number of women running for office. Look at the number of women who are now CEOs running corporations. I mean, there's been a huge change in the culture and really profound changes in social organizations and networks without any legislation. Would you say, I mean, is that an example of an effective movement that perhaps we weren't measuring correctly?
That seems right to me. And I mean, I don't mean to discount, and certainly you don't either, on the contrary, specific tangible goals. But I think it's important to think of social movements as also generating ideas and generating concepts. You know, so there's a tendency, at least among some, to think that activists act and intellectuals think, you know, that the ideas come from one place and the actions come from another. And instead, I think it's important to recognize that in social movements, there's a great deal of theorizing that goes on. And in some ways, some of the most important results of social movements, this is really just another way of saying what you said 5 minutes ago, is to think of their results as conceptual results, as helping or forcing us to think differently. I would say, to go along with what you said about the Me Too movement in the U.S., in Argentina and in some ways spread through Latin America, there's a somewhat parallel movement called Ni Una Menos, like literally not one less, but really that not one more woman will be killed. It's against sexual violence, against gender violence, against what they call femicide. They are much more organized and much more focused structurally on patriarchy and its different effects in other parts of society. And so I think of that conceptual result of a social movement of recognizing white supremacy, of recognizing patriarchy, that is an additional very important result.
Well, and in legislation, even in this country, while there has been legislation that has placed restrictions on non-disclosure agreements, Me Too movement has been cited in legislation to improve the testing of rape kits here in the state of North Carolina and other places. So along those lines, that's the kind of thing you're saying. It has its influence without passing a Civil Rights Act.
Certainly, yes.
But now let's get back to the other. I mean, I mentioned Ella Baker and a robust debate within the SCLC and perhaps the civil rights movement in general about whether it's a centralized or decentralized movement. It was a debate within a movement that was well organized and well understood by the American people. How has this happened? Did it evolve, or was there a discussion about whether we should, you know, obviously the Me Too movement and Black Lives Matter doesn't happen out of a pre-existing organization, right, after a robust debate. It evolves. Is that also part of the change that we're seeing? Movements are more organic and spontaneous?
I think that they are. I pose in the negative way first, in the sense that I think the movements are today, and as the causes, as we've been tracing a decades-long evolution in the name of democracy, they have an allergy to charismatic leadership and an allergy to centralized decision-making, for better or for worse. But I think that that's a very widespread phenomenon. Like I said, I think the first moment should be to recognize and appreciate the important work that and debates from the 1960s that this is evolving from. The second moment, though, after appreciating the importance of it, one should recognize certain pitfalls. Like, for instance, to confuse the critique of leadership with a lack of organization or a lack of institution, then that results in a problem. In some ways, democratic movements have to be more organized, have to focus more on institution. And so how to I think this is a question that activists today are confronting, how to organize an effective and long-lasting social movement democratically in a decentered way, in a way that we make decisions over the most important matters collectively and democratically. It's not an easy task, but it's on the agenda.
Well, I mean, let's say that this was some of the debate in the aftermath of the French Revolution, right? I mean, how are we going to organize ourselves? Okay, great, we got rid of the king. Now, what do we do? And wasn't this, to some extent, how we go forward? Now we don't have the strong leader anymore, and how do we build a framework for deciding that? And then, what does it look like when we're finished? So, my point is, it's an old argument. How have the new realities of contemporary, both global economy, digital media, have they had any impact on the way these are being structured or not structured?
You know, I think with the question of social media and digital media, I think I see it as in some ways the inverse of the way it's usually presented. Like many of these movements are presented, say, starting with Iran, but then certainly with the Arab Spring, as if they're Twitter movements or Facebook movements, as if the technology created the decentralized nature of the movements. I think it's the opposite, which is more interesting, which is that the decentralized nature of the movement made these technologies appropriate for them. And so that in some ways, various forms of new media and digital technologies have proved very useful organizing and communication tools within these movements because of a corresponding geometry, because they have the same network structure. That said, though, I think it's a misreading to think of these movements only in terms of, or maybe to overemphasize the role of social media in them or different media, because they've, at the same time that there's been more communication through these channels, there's also been an intense physical presence. Like, think about all of the different occupations and encampments, you know, from Tahrir Square through Madrid or Zuccotti Park or Oakland. They function in some ways in the ether, you know, through the internet, but in other ways, they live together for months at a time, you know, with an intense personal relationship. So one shouldn't think of, I think that there are two ways of the communication has developed within social movements, in some ways with a very even increasingly intense being together, and also with a greater usage of the appropriate technologies, the technologies that correspond to the forms that the activists are already related in.
What's the scale that you think, I'm going to just ask you, can be most effective? Obviously, this varies in this dynamic environment that we're in. But can movements be organized? The global economy, global capitalism is the sort of the overlord and the foundation of all of this, right? It's big. It's very large. Is that the enemy in all of this? Is that what you organize against or around? Or do you have to do it at the micro level? Each community finds its own issue and then organically, resists in that way.
There's also, since you were bringing up earlier, certain central debates in the 1960s in the U.S. There was already then this question about whether democracy is possible at a larger scale, or whether democracy is only possible in the face-to-face and the community level, et cetera. I think that that's in some ways this question about decision making is one that various movements in the last decade have been trying to confront at a larger scale, how to make decisions. So the General Assembly in various, you know, since 2011 has been one model, however imperfect, of a trying to address at relatively large scales, but still small. You know, I remember in Barcelona there was, you know, one of these General Assemblies to try to make a decision. They had about 3,000 people in the square. They were using Twitter as a mechanism for trying to make decisions together. These seem like, you could say, bound to fail, but certainly very positive experiments. So trying to work through mechanisms for making democratic decisions at larger scales, I think this is, and we can point to many other, like just to stay within the Spanish example again, there are several political parties that have evolved out of the movements that sprung up in 2011. The Barcelona city government now is controlled by a party that grew out of the movements and has been trying since they were in office to transform the decision-making level, procedure at the city level? Like, how can we make democratic decisions about important questions about the municipality, about our energy structure, about others? How can we make that more democratic? That seems like a ways in which an experiment with, however imperfect, like I was saying before, of translating the democracy that's demanded by these social movements into a larger structure.
So maybe there are these proto-movements already underway that are off our radar because they're networks of people engaged in the problem at different levels of scale. And they won't be obvious to us until they come to fruition. Is that maybe what's happening right now?
You know, I think in part, I find it's almost always true that I'll talk about social movements and inevitably someone I'm talking to will lament that nothing's going on anymore. Mm. And what it is just that they're not paying attention. Mm-hmm. So I think there's always under the radar innumerable, actually quite inspiring and productive movements that are going unnoticed, and even more so in an age like ours in which there isn't that same centralization and figure of a spokesperson or leader that then publicizes it. But that said, I think you're right. I mean, I think that's a very good instinct to think about and try to link together the various movements that are existing, going on, often at scales that don't seem like they're world-changing, but in fact could be. I mean, the other thing that's important to me, like I would call those at first, I would call them transversal connections. I don't know if that makes sense, you know, between the similarities and even resonances between indigenous rights movements and feminist movements and anti-racist movements, etc. But then they also have international connections. I mean, like we were just talking about the ways in which there are resonances between the Me Too movement in North America and Europe and the Neo-Namenos in Argentina, so that there's a number of connections one can work through.
Great stuff. As always, Michael Hart, professor of political theory in the Department of Literature, Duke University, co-director of the Social Movements Lab, and co-author of the book Assembly. Michael, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
You get links to his book and his work at our website, stateofthings.org. Produced by the show is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.